Stories both personal and scientific abound in Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha Mukherjee is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University in New York and a staff cancer physician at the medical center there. His last book, The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, won a Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for 2011. Siddhartha Mukherjee joined us in September 2011 to talk about that book, so we welcome him back to The Exchange. Good to have you, Dr. Mukherjee.
Thank you for having me.
You begin with mental problems in your own family members. I mean, given the reluctance to even admit them in your family, was there any discussion of heredity?
You know, I begin with the history of schizophrenia and bipolar disease in my two uncles. And absolutely, there was a big reluctance to discuss them, to understand them. But when that crossed one more generation to my one of my cousins on the same side of the family, that history just couldn't be ignored. We could not just put it away and not talk about it. I say that, you know, my parents had elevated, like most families, they'd elevated denial to a museum-grade art. But it was impossible not to acknowledge it. And very soon in my own life, particularly when I went to visit my cousin with my father, it had to be acknowledged.
You mention a Swedish study of heredity and mental illness from 2009. Was that a fairly definitive one that kind of set the current path we're on now?
Well, there have been many, many studies following that one, so that's just one of them. But we now know that, I mean, we had known this for a while, but we now know that at least schizophrenia and bipolar disease have a strong genetic component. We know that there can be a familial version of them. That means one in which it crosses several generations in the same family. And we know more and more that most of these are carried not by one gene but by multiple genes, and they get ultimately sort of activated potentially by triggers or by chance. So there's a complex interaction. But the fact that there's a genetic link at the lurking in the back of all of this, particularly schizophrenia and bipolar disease, has been clear. For other mental illnesses, it depends on the kind we're talking about. It's been less clear.
You answered the question already that there may, in fact, be a gene or sets of genes for bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. But it seems like we've reached a point in history when that's one of our first assumptions. I mean, there's a gene for that. There's got to be a gene that makes this happen. I mean, is that where we are working from now?
No, I think that, and in fact, the book, I try to point out the errors of that kind of thinking. Virtually all complex diseases that we encounter are the result of not one gene, but multiple genes. And virtually all complex diseases that we encounter are the result of genes interacting with environments and chance. There are obviously exceptions to that. You know, there are some diseases that tend to be rarer, although, you know, occasionally we certainly see them. There's some illnesses where it's only one gene gene variant or a mutation that contributes to that disease. Huntington's disease is a classic example of that. If you have the mutated version of that Huntington's disease gene, then chances are that you will develop Huntington's disease in your lifetime. On the other hand, there are most common chronic diseases that we encounter, including diabetes, including heart disease, and other things, mental illness, are mostly controlled by multiple genes.
So the very idea of the gene, you write, is both powerful and dangerous. How dangerous?
It's dangerous because for two reasons. One of them is that, you know, as we move into new arenas of technology, we're learning to read our genome. The genome is just essentially a giant encyclopedia of all the genes in our body and all the sequences that regulate them and tell them where to go on and where to go off. And lots of other sequences that we don't know the function of. What's happened in the last 10 odd years is that we've been able to start reading the human genome, individual genomes, individual sets of genes, and potentially predicting some future risk or future properties. And also more recently, we've been able to write it. By that I mean we've been able to change the human genome. And that's obviously a powerful idea. It opens up the possibility of attacking and changing the courses of potentially complicated illnesses that we haven't been able to attack and change the course of so far, including cancer. But on the other hand, we know from our history that genetic technologies have been used very inappropriately in the past. I'm thinking particularly about Nazi eugenics. I'm thinking about American eugenics. I'm thinking about eugenics in Europe in general. So there's a warning label that should come with the use of genes and all the unintended consequences that we might unleash once we start tampering with genomes.
Even before we get to philosophical things like thinking that society would be better if we got the genes of, I don't want to use the words they used back then, but we'll get to them later. Is there a danger that we know just enough to be a problem in the sense that we think, we know enough to be able to change this now and let's try this. Oops.
I think that there's a lot of caution in the air because of this history. I don't think, I think that's very unlikely that at least in the United States that people would be cavalier about changing human genomes or any genome, actually. I think there's a lot of thought and caution put into it. The real question is, is there a consensus across the world about this? I note with some importance that the first experiment to alter the human the genome of a human embryo was performed in China. And in China, it was an experiment that was controlled somewhat because they were non-viable human embryos. You couldn't form human beings out of them. But it was just an important road point in the roadmap.
Much more to talk about with Siddhartha Mukherjee. His latest book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. He is on the road promoting it, joins us from Seattle. We'll come back and talk more with him about genes and genetics and more than just the physical aspects of it all, but now philosophy and science end up intertwined here as well. Much more to talk about. We'll come back and talk more with Siddhartha Mukherjee about The Gene and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Siddhartha Mukherjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Columbia University, Staff Cancer Physician at the Medical School there, and a Pulitzer-winning author for his last book, The Emperor of All Maladies. He follows that with a look at genes in the book, The Gene, An Intimate History. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So back in time to the beginning of our study of genes, Gregor Mendel, the monk who studied peas, we all heard about him in seventh grade, I think. How bad was he as a parish priest?
Well, we know just a little bit from notes that I sort of looked at and gathered over writing the book. He was bad enough that he never really succeeded at that job. He spent his time instead working in the Abbey garden, where he discovered the idea. He didn't coin the word gene, but he discovered the idea of it.
So I never heard this in school, but Mendel had a fairly prominent physics teacher.
Absolutely. I mean, this was much later in his life. He went to study under Christian Doppler, and who actually was very inspiring to Mendel. Doppler is famous for the famous Doppler effect, which is that when something is speeding towards you, it seems to turn more blue in color if it's emitting light, whereas if it's speeding away from you, that same light emitting source turns more red. Then there's a classic experiment in which Doppler loaded a train. This is a great story. He loaded a train full of trumpeters, and he asked them to hold one note. And he put because no one believed him, and he put a bunch of observers at the station, and you heard that famous sound, that happens when you have a train coming towards you and then going away, that sound shift. And what's interesting is that Mendel was very inspired by this kind of idea that Doppler had, that there could be lurking underneath what seemed kind of obvious ideas in science, there could be lurking things that were deeper principles. And, of course, he uncovered one of the greatest deeper principles, and that's the idea that there are genes lurking behind what seems to be, human heredity.
So before Gregor Mendel, what was the general thought about how traits were passed on?
There were thousands of ideas, and I talk about them in the book. Some of them are very entertaining and very important. One common idea, was that traits just blended together. That you're from one parent you'd get one set, from another parent you'd get another set, and the child was some kind of wearing blender, and the child would mix together these two things, and therefore you'd have the final product. If you had a parent with blue eyes and another parent with yellow eyes, you'd get a child with green eyes, basically. And so this was a classic idea. It had stayed for a long time. And the other idea, which I actually found fascinating, was an idea called preformation, in which people argued that heredity was transmitted by, in the sperm, there was already a little human being, and all you had to do was add water. You know, the human being would sort of unfurl and grow bigger and bigger and bigger. There are no traits that would be passed, as it were. It was just sort of a magnification of a tiny human being wrapped up inside a sperm. It was called a homunculus. And if you thought about that a little bit more, it leads to a fascinating idea that because the homunculus has to give, you know, has to carry forward its own lineage, there must be a homunculus within a homunculus and one within that one. And so like infinite Russian dolls. One out of the other. But this was actually, I mean, we laugh now, but this was one of the most prominent theories of heredity in the past.
The picture is quite compelling. There are illustrations in the book, and the picture of the homunculus in the sperm cell
it's a fascinating picture, too, because it shows a tiny human being, and it's all folded up and wrapped up, sort of like a fetus would be in the womb, but just a minuscule version containing even more minuscule versions inside him or her.
Wow, that's just amazing. And of course, no genetic information from the mother, then, in that case, is what they were thinking.
That's right. I mean, that old idea was that the sperm carried all the genetic information, and the mother basically nourished it and made it blow up like a blow up doll.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is our guest on The Exchange. His latest book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. So here's where Charles Darwin enters, wondering about how all the different species developed. How surprising could his thoughts have been, though, given that people were already breeding changes into farm animals?
They were very surprising for its time. I mean, Charles Darwin really is one of the great, great human scientists in our history. It was very surprising, partly because people didn't think about the natural world this way. There was a long history of breeding, you know, cows with bigger horns and dogs with different temperaments. And so people knew that the human hand could guide certain kinds of breeding. But Darwin's important leap was to say that this is what happens in the natural world over millions of years. And that there is no, you know, there's no de novo creation of all different kinds of animals. But in fact, there's natural selection. Obviously, in the case of humans, there was human selection. But Darwin made the claim that there was natural selection, and natural selection combined with natural variation. So there were, you know, big variations that were found, and nature would select one of them under, in Darwin's understanding, extreme circumstances. And that would cause animals to change their forms over millions of years. A very radical idea for its time.
Truly. So we come back to Gregor Mendel in the book, though, and you say he failed his biology exam twice. Why do you say thankfully?
Well, it's thankfully because, you know, biology in Mendel's time, heredity, as I told you already, was taught in a very wrong-headed way. A lot of biology in Mendel's time was what would be called descriptive. You know, people spent a lot of time saying, well, this is what animals look like. You know, this is the number of vertebrae that a giraffe has. This is the way that a plant looks. And people would make, you know, biologists, anatomists would make detailed drawings, and they would show these various kinds of pictures of what animals look like. Mendel and Darwin as well made an incredible leap. They turned that idea into what would be called mechanistic, which is to ask the question, why do things look like that? Why does heredity move like that? Not what it is. Don't describe it for me, but tell me why it happens. What is the underlying phenomenon that's driving this? And so both of them were, you know, the two most radical ideas to emerge in 20th century biology came from that time.
The stories of Mendel are just abound. I mean, he had actually tried before he did the peas. He tried to breed mice. What happened with that?
Well, you know, Mendel was a monk, and one of the things that's very instructive about the book, I think, and instructive about our times too, is that he was an Augustinian monk, and Augustinians didn't see a giant conflict between science and their religion. In fact, they encouraged their monks to read about science, etc. So it's a good thought for our current times, very divisive times. But going back to Mendel, you know, he tried to breed mice, and that was just a little bit too much for the monks. I mean, you know, they said, they really wanted to emphasize that you could, you know, work in the garden with the peas and so forth. But having him work on mice was maybe a little bit too much, too risque to breed things artificially to illustrate principles of heredity.
All right, so peas they were okay with, and he figured out things like the traits like wrinkled or smooth and a bunch of other traits there. He could duplicate the results over and over again. He prepared his stuff, as you point out, in 44 spectacularly dreary pages. So what happened when he published his work? Was there much response to it at all?
There was very little response. I mean, you know, again, to remind ourselves why it's all exciting. Mendel had discovered that, unlike what we just said, things don't move in, you know, things don't blend like a wearing blender, that hereditary traits are carried forward in a unit form. They're like indivisible, almost like particles. Now, again, he didn't coin the word gene, but he'd essentially stumbled on the basic features of what genes are. But having done all of this, his paper was largely ignored. No one really read it, and it was mostly sort of put by the wayside until it would be discovered really 35 years after.
Well, it's a long time to be on the shelf. The book about Gregor Mendel and Charles Darwin and many other people is called The Gene, An Intimate History. It includes some family history from Siddhartha Mukherjee himself. This is the follow-up to The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, the Pulitzer winner from 5 years ago. Here is Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thank you. I have a question as far as schizophrenia with a family, and we're strictly dealing with separate sexes. And I was wondering if it could be transferred with that same sex, male or female, down three generations and actually skipping the middle generation.
Oh, good question. Thanks for that, Bill.
Very good question. And the quick answer is absolutely it can. I mean, there seem to be not just genetic influences, but also environmental triggers and some role of chance. That pattern has been observed, certainly across multiple different studies. You could skip a generation and have it arise again. I mean, generally speaking, of course, it depends on what variation of schizophrenia we're talking about. There are many, many, many variants and many, many different genes. But that precise pattern has been observed, absolutely.
All right. So the ways in which people began to apply the knowledge of genetics. Now, you said that Mendel did not apply the term gene. Where did that come from?
That came years later. In the early 1900s, when biologists went back to Mendel's work, they began to realize that this was not very profound, because all of a sudden they began to realize that, you know, all this information is traveling through the biological world. I mean, the fact that you and I look like each other, the fact that, you know, we can grow out of an embryo and create a form that looks like a human being with many variations, all of that could be explained by this passage of this information. So they began to look for a word for it, and there were lots of choices, and ultimately, you know, Walter Johansson, a botanist, came upon that word gene. He used that.
Now, between Mendel's publication and its rediscovery, Francis Galton set to work, and he did have a few things right, as you point out, even though ended up in eugenics.
Francis Galton is a fascinating character, and he reminds us about, you know, how powerful and beautiful and how dangerous the idea of the gene can be. Galton actually resisted the idea of the gene for a long time. He was not convinced. He didn't like the idea, but he tried to perform his own experiments to figure out how heredity worked. But in his later life, he was Darwin's cousin. He sort of lived under Darwin's shadow to some extent. But he was brilliant in his own right, great statistician, great mathematician. And Galton began to ask the question, well, what if we use breeding, selective breeding, to make human beings better, to emancipate the human race? And he called that eugenics, meaning, you know, good genes. And that would become the basis. I mean, many, many people signed on to Galton's theory. It was considered a very progressive theory that, you know, why not make the world better? Why not make human beings better by selectively breeding human beings? And as we'll talk about, I'm sure, that would soon sort of begin to transform into a much more macabre form, not just of selective breeding, but of selective sterilization and eventually selective extermination, a very nasty way of changing the human gene pool.
You let us see that continuum in a way I don't think it's ever been expressed before in this book. The idea that, let's promote this turns into let's stop that and finally let's kill them.
That's a very important idea to remember, that, you know, that road to hell was often paved by progressive intentions to make human beings better. But in fact, it made us substantially worse.
Well, and we can't console ourselves that this happened just in Nazi Germany. It was fairly widespread in the United States as well.
That was a discovery that stunned me, and I think we need to read about that. That discovery really stunned me. That you know, eugenics was conceived of first in England, and as I said then, it was a very progressive idea. People loved the idea, and then it metastasizes. That idea metastasizes not first to, you know, how we know it today, but first to the United States, where states signed on to the idea that you could sterilize someone for carrying bad genes. And famously, a young woman named Carrie Buck in Virginia was confined, and by state mandate, by Supreme Court mandate, she was allowed to be sterilized for carrying genes for mental illness. This was not long ago. This was in the 1920s. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, the famous judicial moderate, came down with the opinion that three generations of imbeciles was enough, he wrote, and therefore mandated that Carrie Buck could be sterilized, her ovaries could be removed so that she wouldn't be able to pass on the genes for mental illness to her children. In fact, in retrospect, it turns out that whole thing was quite a sham. Carrie Buck actually had no real history of mental illness, at least to write home about it when we reexamine the case. So it's a real reminder that things can go wrong in very wrong directions because you're playing with a particular kind of fire that has to do with how we think of ourselves as human beings. That's what is interesting about this book. As I wrote it, I began to realize how things have gone wrong in the past.
There's a whole, there's, you know, the whole book about the Carrie Buck case. We had the author on a few months ago, and the fact that they even had these classifications of idiot, moron, and imbecile that they thought actually were scientific, just it blows your mind, particularly to find out that Oliver Wendell Holmes was the one who wrote the opinion.
Yeah, and you know, he was writing for his time. This was very much part of his time. The people really thought that you would help the human race by sterilizing those who were carrying bad genes.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. Here is Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You may or may not be able to answer this question, but it is very interesting either way. I wonder if you can, are twins or multiples in birth where the cell splits? I thought that was strictly a genetic condition.
Well, the quick answer is it's not strictly a genetic condition. I don't explore it in great depth in the book, but it's not strictly a genetic condition. Twins can happen spontaneously. You know, as you know, there are at least two kinds of twins, identical and fraternal. Some of it has to do with chance. There are families in whom twindom runs, and they've certainly been documented, but it's not a completely genetic determinant.
All right, another question here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for taking my call. I hope this applies. During the sports days of East Germany and Russia, Soviet Union, I mean, we know the stories of them doping their athletes and not even telling them. Was this, you know, any way connected to what you're talking about? Frontline did a fantastic program called Doping for Gold, and it was about what really was going on behind the scenes in East Germany. So if that applies, why don't you make your comment, please? Thanks.
All right, thank you, John.
This was not a doping issue, but I mean, I think you're talking about what happened in Germany. It was not a doping issue in the 1930s and 1940s, but the relationship between athletes is very important because simultaneously, and I talk about this in great detail, simultaneously while the state was trying to stir up, was trying to exterminate the weak and those that were disabled on genetic pretexts. The Olympics was used as a showcase for what could be achieved as a kind of human perfection in human bodies. I mean, this was the famous, the series of unbelievable photographs. I think I have one in the book in which the perfect Aryan German body was displayed, kind of to generate passive consent for what was happening behind the scenes of extermination. You know, this was what would happen, and there were propaganda films that were filmed and shown, and often had huge audiences in which they would try to stir up propaganda. On one hand, displaying these great, perfect athletic individuals, and contrasting them with those that were considered defective, so that people would sort of passively agree that this was the best thing to do for Germany.
Were the geneticists in some countries making themselves heard and saying, you're using this the wrong way? I'm just curious to know how strong the scientific backlash against eugenics was.
There were certainly geneticists who were concerned enough to not consent. There were lots of physicians as well. We can talk about them. But it was really the humanists who came out and said, you know, this has got to stop.
And indeed it did, but not very soon. The book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha Mukherjee is the author of that and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him about genes, genetics, and the ways in which we have interpreted what we've learned through history when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Siddhartha Mukherjee. The name might be familiar, assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University, staff cancer physician at the Columbia University Medical School, the author of The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, which won the Pulitzer Prize 5 years ago. He's out with a new book about genes and genetics called The Gene, An Intimate History. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what we know about genes and genetics and how we've used and misused that information over the years. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. To join us by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. I love the stories about Thomas Morgan. This is a guy I really enjoy reading about, but I'm really glad I never had to enter his lab. It sounds like a very gross place.
It was not that. You know, Thomas Morgan worked on fruit flies. He used fruit flies to figure out some of the most important things that we know about genes. I mean, he used fruit flies, for instance, to figure out that before Morgan came on the scene, no one really knew what a gene looked like. I told you this already. We talked about this a little bit already. You know, Mendel had discovered genes by breeding plants, and he'd figured out that they're indivisible, that they look, they're like particles. But no one knew what kind of particles were they. Were they what was carrying them from, you know, from parents to children? And Morgan, using fruit flies, figured out an incredibly important idea that they were sort of genes were strung along the chromosome. He had other people who, you know, helped him figure out he's not the only character. But the idea that genes were strung along a chromosome like beads on a string was Morgan's idea, and he discovered it again by breeding flies. And looking at and seeing that, you know, how genes intersected with as they moved across multiple generations. And that was this, all of a sudden, genes were not an abstraction anymore. They were not something that, you know, there's some ghost lurking somewhere. They were carried by a part of the cell, the chromosomes. And when chromosomes moved from one cell to the next cell, they carried genes with them and on them, like beads on a string again. So that was Thomas Morgan's incredible contribution.
Do we know, though, at this point, what it is that makes certain genes express and others not? Is it just a series of on-off switches for each gene?
Yes. So we know the basic outline. It's a very important outline. The genome is not a passive blueprint. It's an active blueprint. And what the genome does is that it makes products. It's used to build proteins and RNA. I talk about them in the book. And these proteins essentially then conduct the genome. It's a lovely idea that the proteins then conduct the genome as like a master conductor. And in every cell, these proteins come and turn certain genes on and certain genes off. And a different cell, they turn different genes on and different genes off. And by doing so, they can take the same genome and make multiple different cell types out of it. It's a lovely idea. It's like saying that in one cell, you take the same master score or the same sheet music, and you only play the black keys, and you'll get a very different symphony. In another cell, you take the same sheet music, and you play only the white keys in that sheet music, or only the third bar or the seventh bar. And the example is extreme, but in fact, what happens is that proteins conduct the genome so that we get very different outcomes out of the same genes.
Now, we talked about Thomas Morgan just now, but one of the people who trained with him, Theodosius Dobzhansky, did some great work as well following that and was able to sort of reconnect back to Darwin. What did Dobzhansky figure out?
He advanced Morgan's work, and he began to figure out how genes were reconciled with evolution. So, you know, Darwin had, of course, never fully fathomed the idea of the gene. But Dobzhansky used all of this information to figure out that, you know, what was really happening during natural selection was that genes were being selected in flies, for instance. And he was able to show, number one, that in the wild, there are multiple variations that occur. And that's because of genes. Darwin would have predicted it, but Dobzhansky showed it. And that when natural selection happens, what's really happening is that gene populations or gene frequencies are changing. So Dobzhansky sort of reconciled Mendel and Darwin.
Which is an amazing feat. You skip ahead a few years. Let's skip ahead a few years to Watson and Crick. I love the descriptions of their personalities. These were not easy guys to be around from the sounds of it.
I mean, they were brilliant. They were zany. They were very playful. They also were obsessed with solving the structure of DNA, resulting in the famous Watson and Crick structure. So the double helix came out of their work. So they, you know, like all scientists, they were idiosyncratic. And, you know, thank God for that.
So why is the double helix so important to understanding genes and genetics?
Well, first of all, it sort of brings, we talked a little bit about Thomas Morgan and how every year or every decade brought more and more clarity to what a gene was and made it more and more obvious what that looked like. The double helix was the final version of that. So it ultimately said, you know, this is what DNA looks like. DNA ultimately gets packaged into chromosomes and chromosomes get moved from one cell to the other. But really, this is what the gene looks like. So that was, it was like the crystallization, as it were, of the most beautiful idea of what genes look like. But also what's important is that it was the structure of the double helix is very beautiful, and it predicts many, many things about how and why genes behave that way. It's a double helix because when a cell reproduces, you can imagine the double helix as a yin and yang structure. Well, it's a double helix, and the yin is copied and made into a yang, and the yang gets copied and made into a yin, and that's how genetic material gets duplicated. So that's a beautiful idea there, that the fundamental nature of the gene, which is to carry information from one cell to its daughter cells or from one animal to its daughter animals, is contained within that structure. It's a magically beautiful idea.
I'm struck throughout this book, and I guess not just this book, but any history of a certain kind of science, by how often scientists reach similar or same conclusions around the same time? Is it just that science has a way of setting out questions and many people set to work on it at one time?
Well, I think some of it is dependent also on the technologies that are available at any time. Crystallography was developed as a technique, the idea that you could find the structure, the shape of a molecule by shining, very high intensity light was discovered at the time, and of course Watson and Crick were able to use that idea. Fruit flies became a model organism to discover many basic things about genes because people got interested in finding organisms to look for these kinds of questions. And scooting forward, the Human Genome Project wouldn't have been solved in the way it's been solved had it not been for the technology of being able to sequence all our genes. So it's a mixture of all the new technologies and also, incredible insights that result from those new technologies.
Let's talk about the Human Genome Project and the fact that we have figured it all out. So we know, to use your analogy, it's an encyclopedia. So we have the encyclopedia. What do we do with it now? What do we know that we didn't used to know?
Well, we know that it's a vast encyclopedia. It's 3 billion letters long. If it was written as a standard, in standard font, it would be actually 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Wow.
And it would look inscrutable to you and me. It would look like, because it's all written in four letters, it would be ACT, GCCC, TCC, GG, so forth, for 3 billion letters. And yet, here's the astonishing thing, and I discuss this in the book. A cell in your body, like an embryonic cell, the first fertilized cell, can interpret, has the tools to interpret that 66 set of encyclopedia and make you and me. And that remains a mystery. How does it make you and me out of that big set of ACT and Gs? Well, we know some of the answers, and I try to answer that in the book, but the real question is, how does it do so? And it's an incredible idea.
Let us take another call. Here is Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Siddhartha Mukherjee, the author of The Gene, an Intimate History.
Study. Recently, we've been messing around, modifying, engineering, changing the genome. Do you have any ideas on how long it's going to take before this actually turns around and bites us in the butt?
The actual manipulation of genes, you're concerned? Okay, that's the project.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, it's it's wonderful that you're calling from a place called Eugene.
they don't practice eugenics there.
No, but they don't. But the word comes from the same root, obviously. Mm-hmm. But so it's a very important question, and the question is, how close are we to modifying the human genome? The quick answer is we already can. We can modify the human genome right now in a way that we couldn't do 5 or 10 years ago. My laboratory is working on, along with 1,000 others, is working on ways to do this, in my case in cancer. But the quick answer is that in the last 5 years, we've discovered astonishing new tools to be able to manipulate and change the human genome in ways that we just hadn't imagined possible years ago. So that these technologies are new, we're trying to figure out what to do with them. And in the book, I really discuss what I think should be strong limits on these kinds of manipulations, particularly in embryos. I think, number one, that we shouldn't be doing any manipulation unless there's really extraordinary suffering involved. We shouldn't be tampering with the human genome lightly. Number two, that we should be doing it when we are certain that there's a gene that's linked to something, not because we want to change height or where there are multiple genes involved, or weight, where there's multiple genes involved, but really when there's a one-to-one correspondence. But perhaps most importantly, we need a public conversation about it. That's why we need to have all this vocabulary. You need to participate. We need to be armed, to be, because otherwise the scientific world will run away from us. And it should be done with freedom, with consent, and with no state mandate, as has been used. So I call this a triangle. In the book, you can read more about that triangle, but it's an important set of parameters that I think we should use to judge what happens in the future.
How close are we? I mean, could we get to the... And let me give a scenario here, because I can almost hear somebody asking this. It's like, well, if you can switch off the breast cancer genes, why don't you give her blue eyes while you're at it? I mean, what would be the problem there?
Well, the problem... There would be many problems. Number one is that we'd be changing identity, and I think that there are humanistic reasons that we should be careful about what changes in identity could be or should be. Your preference for blue eyes could be someone else's preference for brown eyes and so forth, and tampering with it at the genetic level means that we're changing the human gene pool forever. So this is not something we can do casually, and I talk about this extensively in the book, which is really, I think we should put strong gaps, make very strong distinctions between, for instance, the Huntington's disease genes, which causes a devastating illness, and something that has no relationship, as far as we can tell, to illness, like blue eyes.
I was reading about CRISPR, and I know that is mentioned in the book here, which is it's an acronym for a process, which sounds fascinating, but apparently also concerns people, as does anything else in genetic manipulation.
Well, CRISPR is just a system that is borrowed, that we've borrowed from bacteria. Bacterial cells have, they're constantly invaded by other viruses, and they attack those viruses by essentially attacking their DNA and changing it. And we've now started using that system. We've hijacked that system. And instead of having bacteria attack viruses and change their genomes, we're trying to use that to change the human genome by changing the information. And it works with astonishing fidelity as far as we can tell. We're trying to figure out whether there are unintended side effects of it, whether there'll be problems with using it in the future, but essentially it opens the door to changing the human genome, erasing one little word in that encyclopedia set and substituting it for a different word.
Which has a lot of potential repercussions.
That's why we need to have this conversation now, before we move forward, because obviously the repercussions are enormous, and they have to do with, things that the book deals with. I mean, what does identity mean? What does it mean to be ourselves? What parts of it ourselves are in genes and versus in the environment, so or chance. And so we really need to grapple with these questions as we move forward.
So we hear the concerns here, but what's your greatest hope about the abilities we have now to write genes rather than just to read them?
Well, I think the greatest hope is that we'll use this technology for wonderful things like curing diseases that have no other treatments or cures. We'll use it to make ourselves, we'll use it to reduce suffering and reduce vulnerability. And that ultimately that we'll be able to get a handle on this technology and use it for the best possible things. The concern is that, we'll use it to make new medicines, new vaccines, new ways of treating cancer. The concern is that on the road we'll get lost and start also tampering with parts of the genome that we don't know how to deal with, especially parts that don't have to do with suffering.
So, Dr. Mukherjee, you mentioned something about a state mandate. You want to make sure there's nothing of that in genetics. What kind of mandate were you concerned about?
Well, you know, we've talked a little bit about this in the past. The state mandate to screen your children to make sure that they don't have any deleterious mutations, that should be something that everyone is free to do. And if you don't want to do it, you should be able to have a child that you want to have without having to undergo that kind of process. A state mandate might involve having to change a certain gene in a child, unborn child. Again, that should be something I think that should be governed by a complete freedom. You should be able to do what you want to do and have self-determination in choosing the kind of offspring you'd like to have.
It's a very exhaustive and detailed book, and yet a lot of fun to read at the same time. A lot of stuff in here that's called The Gene and Intimate History, written by Siddhartha Mukherjee, who also wrote the Pulitzer-winning The Emperor of All Maladies. Thanks so much for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure. I'm a big fan of your show.